write a
IOU.
we had a purchase book, and we just wrote that out and gave a copy to the Ontario Provincial, and they used that to claim the funds from the federal government. So on.
What about this business, though, of hitting a cache that's supposed to be there, and one, if you can't find it, and number two, if you did find it and it was empty?
Well, you would really be in trouble. and you would have to, if there was no means of communication, you'd just have to sit there until somebody came and searched for you and brought you some fuel. And that did happen at times. People got lost. Stranded, not lost.
Did you not ever think that maybe there's something wrong here? Maybe we shouldn't be flying over these blank parts of the map?
Well, no, you didn't think about things like that. It was all good fun. That was great experience. And you could see young officers in the service were given great responsibility. It was a pretty precious thing to be delivered, and you had to make your own decisions, and right from the beginning of your career, you were taking the decisions of importance. Yeah, make or break.
Yeah.
Well, as I say, the trip back to Ottawa was uneventful. It was done on about three different railroads. The one from the Hudson Bay took us to the Paw, and then another line from the Paw took us down to Winnipeg, and then Winnipeg to Ottawa. And I wasn't back there more than a few days before I was off on another mission. And this just shows the variety of things you ran into. Are you near the end of that role?
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah.
I was called into the flight commander's office and said, we're sending the Ford Tri Motor down to participate in forest dusting in north shore of the St. Lawrence River.
That was
way down
plane,
the St. Lawrence.
It
was the one and only Ford Tri-Motor in Canada at that time. It was a very big plane, as planes went in those days. Big metal plane. First time I'd ever seen a metal plane. Made by the Stout Aircraft Corporation in Dearborn, Michigan. It was one of the subsidiaries of Ford Motor Company. Well, my mission was to go down there and put in a mooring for the Ford Tri-Motor, which was equipped on floats at that time. We were using it on floats. Put in a mooring suitable for it to use on this dusting operation. They were having trouble with an insect called the hemlock looper.
The infamous hemlock looper.
The spruce budworm and the hemlock looper were giving trouble down in Quebec. And this aircraft was equipped for dusting purposes with a hopper that was supposedly would carry 2,000 pounds of dust. Our experience with dusting up to that time had been with the wheat fields out in the prairies, with the Keystone Puffer. Keystone Puffer, I think, carried about 1,000 pounds.
This is the duty of the Royal
Canadian
Air Force.
Oh, yes.
Let me flip over the page, if I may, sir. I got a few questions to ask here.
Yeah.
My God. My name is Chris Main. I'm with Air Marshal C.R. Dunlap, CBE, and the date today is 21 August, and we're continuing to be started. Now, sir, we're getting out of whack here. Now, first of all, what in the hell is the RCAF doing crop dusting? I can understand ferrying planes, and I can understand helping the civilian photographic survey for mapping, because you're helping yourself there as well. But crop dusting?
Yeah. Well, I guess the answer to that was that there wasn't any civil operator at that time who had either the aircraft or the capital or the equipment to take on this sort of undertaking. And the Air Force, in response to an appeal from either the Department of Agriculture, which is the federal government department, or from the Department of Forestry, it wasn't the Department of Forestry, I guess, but anyway, the department that was responsible for forestry, would respond and would undertake these missions until such time as a civil outfit was equal to the task, had the equipment to do the task. And we pioneered in some of these fields until civil operators could take over. And that applied to photography, too. We pioneered in that. Because there just weren't civil operators with the equipment, and the cameras were so damn expensive in those days. It took a long time. Those barnstormers didn't have the money to put into to things like that. So that's the reason we were into all sorts of peculiar undertakings. And, I could name lots of others, but crop dusting and forest dusting. That is really a far cry from the line of activity you expect an airman in the RCAF to be into.
Let's, if we can, looking over what was done, we missed your flight training in Borden. Yeah. So if we can take just a few minutes out and go back to Borden, because we got you over it.
I'm not going back to Borden just yet. I want to finish this.
Okay, finish the crop dusting.
Yeah, right. Because it will only take a moment. My part was put in this morning. I had, anyway, this was way down the St. Lawrence, North Shore of St. Lawrence, at a place called Manicouagan, yeah, that's right, Manicouagan. To get there, I had to go by rail to Quebec City, and then get on the steamship line, and sail down the North Shore of St. Lawrence, way down, passed the mouth of the Saguenay River.
And this is what, so 1929?
29, yeah. We went on another 100 miles or 200 miles, we got in which, how much. Down to a place called Park City where I disembarked. And I had said to, before I left Ottawa, now what am I going to use for this morning? Am I to take something with me? Oh, no, you have to use your ingenuity. You just take a requisition book.
And when
when you get down there, you'll have to provide, meet your, fulfill the requirement with, as best you can. So at Park City, I purchased a few clamps and cables and so on, which I might use. And I had in my mind sort of what I would use for the buoy itself, and I didn't really have in mind what I was going to use for the anchor, because the Ford Trimotor was a very big plane, and in the high wind you had to have a pretty substantial anchor. So I hired a boat, a French Canadian operating it, who didn't speak very much English, and he and I set out for the Manicouagan, which was our first 20 miles. So all the way along I was searching for something I might use for an anchor. I made a number of inquiries, and somebody said they thought there was an old ship's anchor on the shore, and at a certain point, so we were there. Sure enough, there was a great big ship's anchor, and I suppose been there for 100 years or more, but a little bit. Pretty rusty. And it weighed hundreds of pounds. It was much bigger than was necessary for the task, but I wasn't going to pass that up because there probably wasn't any other anchor anyplace. So the trick was to get that thing aboard.
Well, you didn't pick it up, you didn't have to buy it or anything?
No, just pick it up. And there was some anchor chain with it. There was some anchor chain not too far from it. So we picked up the anchor, we picked up the anchor chain, and in the process the old French Canadian got his boat aground. And that's where I first discovered that profanity in French language, there were far greater possibilities of profanity in English. He had a vocabulary that would exceed the normal English vocabulary of profanity by tenfold, I think. And he exercised it as he was trying to. He was a one-man crew. He had the tiller back here and the engine control about two or three feet or beyond his reach, and he had to maneuver it back and forth to get it off the ground. And then my education was
taking place.
So we finally got it into place and dropped anchor, and I got this huge chain on there, which would almost, really, it would almost support a battleship. It was so big. And then from that chain, I had ran my steel cable up to the buoy, which I made from a 45-gallon drum. So I had a good buoy, and with a cable around it with a big loop on it, so and lots of good clamps that I bought in Clark City to make it. Neat job of it. So there we were, ready for the Ford Trimotor, which flew in the next day and did its job on the crop testing. Pilot of which was an officer in exchange from the Royal Air Force, the name of Ogilvy Ford, a well-known Scottish family. And he and a fellow by the name of Ewart, I think, was flying his co-pilot on it. And they, although I didn't stay behind to observe their fulfillment of their task there. I understand that the dusting of those hemlock trees or spruce trees, whatever they were. At any rate, it was a great success, and the hemlock looper
was no more.
I don't know how successful they were against the spruce budwer, but I do remember that everybody was thrilled with the success of the attack on the hemlock trooper.
Well, that was the enemy.
Yeah. Now, before we jump back to Camp Borden, I'm just quickly, I'm trying to let you know what happened in the life of a young pilot in the course of a year in those days. Sure. And no sooner I got back to Ottawa, to my own air station, when I was told that I might be required to go to Nova Scotia to become a photographic pilot. Well, of course, I hadn't any experience as a photographic pilot, and that takes a bit of training, so I spent a bit of time in Ottawa Air Station for the next few days getting some instruction on how to fly photographic lines. And that's not a simple operation. And sure enough, the chap who had been ill down in Nova Scotia, it was discovered he wasn't going to be able to return to the detachment, and I was shot off to take his place. So we flew out of by train went down to Halifax, and the photo detachment was at what is now Shearwater. It wasn't called Shearwater in those days. It was called the Dartmouth Air Station, or Eastern Passage Air Station. It was on the site of the one we mentioned the other day.
Well, that's your old stomping ground.
Yeah, that's my old stomping ground, and it was the base that was built and commanded by Commander Richard Byrd, now later Admiral Byrd, great explorer, and he was there during World War One, at the end of World War One, flying HF-2L, Curtiss HF-2L flying boats on anti-submarine patrol, and we had, in fact lived while we were there in the little house that was built for him. Manning officer's residence is built right on there, and it was a nice little base. And if you go there present day, you'll find the hangar still in use that was constructed for his aircraft in 1918. In good shape, the Navy's looking after it well, and they're using it as one of their training buildings. It was right down the water's edge, and again, like Jericho, there was a step way in the top, and one thing another. So we had, I had a couple of months down there. Tail end of that photographic season, and just about the time we were on detached operations from Ottawa Air Station, just about the time we were due to go back to Ottawa, it's freeze up, we were getting long towards freeze up time, not freeze up there, but freeze up in other parts of Canada, we received instructions to proceed post haste to Lac Saint John. Quebec. It's to us at that time that sounded like Northern Quebec. Not very far north anymore, but because there was an aircraft missing, and we were to take part in the search. You never knew when you were going to be called in on search and rescue missions. You know, so.
It's a great affinity, too, for the poor bugger that was on the ground, I guess.
Yeah. So, away we went. We were almost ready, as I say, to return to Ottawa. So we had to pack everything up and take off and head for Quebec. Well, that return journey at the end of the season, when you have to put everything aboard and go, is always a tricky one to get off, because you're often a little bit overloaded. If you have all your camera equipment, you have all your emergency equipment, you've got all the engine supplies that you've been using and so on, spare parts. We got out, and of course, as luck would have it, or as unluck would have it, I guess, the water was glassy on Halifax Harbor that day at Easter Passage. Not very often glassy in that place. It's generally a little ripple of some kind, if not a heavy wind blowing. But there wasn't a breath of wind. And unless you had some wind blowing, it was hard to get those seaplanes off the water. It was a Fairchild seaplane of the smallest type, the thing called the FC2. Triangle-shaped fuselage in cross-section, mm-hmm. with an engine that supposedly developed 225 horsepower, but I think at this stage of the game it's only something of 185. And I had considerable difficulty getting off, but in due course I did, after circling around and trying to make waves and one thing or another. The game that was practiced in those days, you couldn't get off. You circle around tight circles and made waves and then taxied off, tried to take off across the waves. I don't think it had any effect whatsoever. But eventually you did get off, and you sometimes thought you had assistance from it, but all that happened was you used up enough fuel and enough weight to make the difference. Well, I got off and circled around Halifax Harbor for quite a long time while my OC, Eddie Koff, was down there, still unable to get off. And there wasn't any point in my landing back on. I couldn't wait forever for him, so I struck off on my own to the first fuel cache. We hadn't agreed that if we got separated, we'd meet there later on. I don't think the fact that I got off first and left first endeared myself to Ed Koff at all. So some hours later, after I'd landed, he crept in up at Grand Lake, not too far from St. John's, Brunswick, upriver, up to St. John River. And, that was the start of a series of events which eventually got us up to the crossing of the St. Lawrence River. I'd had a bit of trouble with my aircraft along the way because these were fabric-covered aircraft, linen, dope fabric, dope linen. And, I'd been exposed to salt water a good deal down there on the East Coast, and it rotted a bit. So, second day on that flight, I discovered that the linen was peeling, stripping off underneath the fuselage. So we had to make some temporary repairs on that, and then in due course we got to the point of crossing the St. Lawrence. And unfortunately, we hadn't been able to get any good maps of the route. We had good maps up as far as the St. Lawrence, but from there on up to Saguenay, up into Lake St. John, and beyond, we had a very, very poor map, which wasn't really much use at all. And unfortunately, when we crossed the St. Lawrence, we got into snow squall, and there was a pretty heavy storm. This was early snow, because this was in late October. Shouldn't be snowing at that time, but it was. And when we got to the mouth of the Saguenay, and we were going to fly off Saguenay, and Saguenay is a rugged bit of terrain. Hills, they're not really mountains in the sense of mountains out here, but hills that go up to 1,000 feet or more on either side of the river. And the river winds, loops itself back and forth in amongst these high hills. Well, the cloud base was down below the tops of these hills, and it was snowing in places. It wasn't very inviting. My OC wanted to land at Tadoussac, which is the community of the Nazis on the Saguenay. But it was obvious that the water was too rough. Just landing would have been suicidal. Well, it wouldn't have been suicidal, but it would wreck the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And having already had some trouble with this aircraft, I was flying with the fabric stripping off. I wasn't for landing in that rough water. Yet. A, I knew it was going to break the pontoons, and B, it would lead to more trouble with me. So, he had signaled to me, by hand signals, he was going to land. And I was signaling to him to push on up to Saguenay and to hell with landing in that rough place. This sounds a little bit strange, but I should point out that he was a little bit timid about flying. This often happened with some of those lads. He had been hitting the ball a little bit. And he had lost his keenness for flying. And he was sort of, I felt, imbued with a fear rather than an enthusiasm. So I took over and took the lead and pushed up the Saguenay, down underneath the cloud base.
Now he would be what, a flight lieutenant?
He was a flight lieutenant. And he was a wartime, World War I pilot. So he formated on me and he allowed me to, he didn't formate on me, he hung behind. And he allowed me to go up the precipitous areas, and he came along behind. And sure enough, we had a safe passage. It was a risky thing to do, but it was a lesser risk than landing at on the St. Lawrence than on this rough windy condition. So when we got to Lac St. John, I was still in the lead. Lac St. John is a big lake. You couldn't see across it. It's a sort of a great big round lake. But we were getting a little short bow and fuel, and it made sense just to fly straight across the center of this lake. Well, Eddie Kopp wasn't for doing that. He was afraid he might miss the destination at the other end, and he wanted to fly around the shore of the lake, much longer way around. So I just, having already taken the lead earlier, I just pushed across the center of the lake and set course for the Achewan River. That's a mouthful. We were heading for San Feliciano on the Achewan River. So I had set a proper course and hit the river mouth right on the nose and landed at San Feliciano, which was the search center for the lost aircraft. Incidentally, Jim Ullman was one of the pilots was already there taking part in the search. I think I might be saying that. And I landed, and about a half an hour later, in came my companion in his aircraft.
Now, was it just the two of you?
Two aircraft.
Yeah.
Just two aircraft. Just the two of us. And I might say he was a little fuming mad. And we were hardly on speaking for terms for a long time after that. He felt this was an act of great insubordination, that I had not taken the commander's advice to land down there. However, I know he put in a stinking report on this behavior of mine, which in due course, as it transpired, it was a couple of months before we finally did get to all the air stations, that search had to extend through the freeze-up period. We had to change from floats to skis and carry on the search under ski conditions. So it actually was not until the first day of January that we got back to base in Ottawa, having left Ottawa in late October, Halifax in late October. In due course, before we'd arrived at San Feliciano, a second aircraft was missing. one of the RCAF aircraft that was searching for the prospective aircraft, or the mining company's aircraft, that had gone missing too. So we had two aircraft in the hand. One of the aircraft was never found for years and years and years. The other one, the RCF machine, we actually didn't find it. He was so badly off course. But he was able to send his crewman out with an Indian just before the rivers froze over. The very fast rivers coming out of like Manawan and those important lakes up way up. He was able to send a chap down the Parabanka River in late November, I guess it was, and let us know where he was. And so then we knew where he was, we knew where his aircraft was. The pilot, French Canadian boy, the name of Bonnard, was up there awaiting rescue. And we were down there at San Felicio waiting the river there to freeze hard enough for us to get on to skis and operate some skis. So that was the reason it took so damn long to get in there, and then we had to get in and get his aircraft out of the frozen lake, frozen hard and tight into the lake, and get it lifted up and get skis on it, fly skis in there and get them on and get the aircraft out, of course, meet the pontoons there. All of which took us until Christmas and right on into the New Year period. We got him out on Christmas Day, and then the weather was duck for 2 days. We packed up and headed up and on. Well, I've gone into in very considerable length here, but to give you some idea of the variety of activity, that was about a half a year. From the time I left Erica Beach in D.C. until all of this.
When you hit air rescue, though, would they have like specific patterns and like areas that you were responsible for?
Well, on search and rescue then, it would be a matter of searching the route that had been flown by the aircraft. And
you wouldn't know they'd be gone until they didn't show up.
That's right. And then expanding outwards from the route, perhaps in parallel flight lines.
So the guy was still on that route.
Right.
So would they be registering flight plans prior to their flight?
No.
Then how did they get the route?
No, but you see, this the first missing aircraft was operating into Chibokamo. It was the first year that the prospectors had found the big copper deposits there. And although there wasn't a mine there by this time, there was a fair amount of flying from San Felicio into Chibokamo. And that just followed a regular straight line pattern. And that fellow went missing on one of those flights. Disappeared. He was an experienced pilot. And he was flying float planes. And it was a matter, one could only assume that since he was very experienced and flown that route many times, that something had happened to him en route that caused that aircraft to crash land. And the main place of search for him was right along that route, or fairly close to that route. And just to finish that story, some years later, quite a number of years later, two Indians came in to San Felicio and reported that they had found the wreckage of that aircraft. And they wanted a large amount of money to disclose this location, as they argued that they had had to leave their trap lines to come in, and therefore it cost them money, and they wanted several thousands of dollars to recompense for this, for bringing this info. Well, they didn't get all that money, but they were recompensed to some degree, and sure enough, they had found that aircraft, and that aircraft was right on course, right on the straight line between A and B, and it had obviously had an engine failure or something, or maybe another heart failure, I don't know. It was too many years afterwards to find out. But that aircraft had nosed in, and the trees had just pulled it over. He must have gone fairly well, stayed in, because the trees had folded over and covered the aircraft up, and the chances of seeing it from the air were almost nil. And nobody did during the course of the search. The other lad who got lost while he was searching for it created an error that navigators. The pilot was the navigator. We had rather good compasses as compasses went, and most of the aircraft were flying and used the P4 compass, I forgot the designation. But it had a lubber line, just the way a ship's compass has, and it had the needle, the compass needle had was red, sort of a red diamond at the tip of the needle. That's the part that would be pointing north. And the north marker on your compass was also on the lubber line, or on the compass plate. The north point was also marked red. So the technique was always to put red on red. If you wanted to, if you wanted to fly a course, certain, say, 270 degrees, you first of all put red on red, and then you let the needle swing around until you were on a westerly course or whatever course you wanted to fly. Well, he had set this thing up wrong end too. He put the south point of his lubber line on
from the north.
From the north. And of course, he was actually flying in the direction. The weather, there was no sun that day, and he was out. There was heavy cloud and not too good visibility. He didn't realize he was flying the wrong way, so